Hello, welcome to the Beef Cattle Health and Nutrition Podcast, episode 47. I'm your host, Dr. John Campbell. Before I introduce today's guests, I want to give a shout out to another excellent podcast, the Canadian Beef Cattle Podcast, hosted by the Beef Cattle Research Council. This podcast is now live and features the most popular content from beefresearch.ca in a new audio format. Tune in every Tuesday to hear straightforward insights, expert information, and a wealth of practical knowledge on topics ranging from animal health and beef quality to grasslands management, feed efficiency, and environmental stewardship. Subscribe now on your favorite podcast streaming platforms or find weekly episodes on the BCRC podcast page at beefresearch.ca/podcasts. This week, I'm pleased to welcome two great guests to the podcast. Dr. Nathan Erickson's been on the podcast before, and he's a colleague from the Department of Large Animal Clinical Sciences here at the Western College of Veterinary Medicine. He's an experienced clinician with time spent in private bovine practice, and his research expertise is in bovine respiratory disease and vaccines. Along with Nathan, we're joined by Dr. John Ellis, also here from the WCVM, who's a board-certified virologist and pathologist, well-known for his research and knowledge in all the viruses that cause respiratory disease in cattle. This week's topic is about the emergence of a new virus causing disease in cattle in the U.S. called bovine influenza A virus. A quick disclaimer before we start. We recorded this episode on April 12th, and this is a new and emerging disease issue in which the knowledge of the situation and the disease may change over time. What we discuss in this episode may become outdated as new information comes to light. Let's get started. Welcome to the podcast, Nathan and John. Thanks for being here. It's great to have you here, and I appreciate you doing this. And maybe before we get started on our topic for today, I'll get you to introduce yourselves to the listener and tell the audience a little bit about what you do here at the Western College of Veterinary Medicine. Nathan, maybe we'll start with you.
Okay. Hi, John. Thanks very much for having me on today. Yes, I'm Nathan Erickson, and I work at the Western College of Veterinary Medicine in the Department of Large Animal Clinical Sciences. I am also a field service, so I work in the field service section of the VMC. My main area of interest is bovine respiratory disease, and then also in beef production in terms of most of my practice.
Dr. Ellis?
Hi, John. Thanks again for having me as well. I'm in the Department of Veterinary Microbiology. I'm a pathologist / microbiologist. I guess my main interest is respiratory disease, viral respiratory disease. So anytime I hear of an outbreak of something that's associated with that, I kind of get excited.
Yes, me too. And so I'm always interested in outbreaks. And today we want to talk about a very recent outbreak of avian influenza virus, which we're now calling bovine influenza A virus, or influenza A virus dash B, IAVB, I guess is the new name they're giving it. Initially seen in dairy cattle in Texas and now in a few other states. And we should maybe throw the caveat out there that there's new information coming out every day. And this, some of the things we discuss could become dated very quickly as new findings emerge. And the other caveat we should say is that at least myself, I'm not directly involved in any of these investigations, and I'm learning most of my information from the internet and from the American Association of Bovine Practitioners and the USDA and other sources like that. I've watched several good webinars from the AABP. So for those veterinarians that listen to the podcast, and if you're a member of the AABP, take advantage of those resources. And I'm sure there'll be more that we learn as we go along. So let's start with Nathan. Maybe you could just give us a quick description of what these veterinarians and dairy producers saw in terms of clinical signs when this outbreak first started.
Yeah, for sure. So like for myself, even when I first heard about this outbreak, it was just as a low production, essentially. And one of my colleagues here at the Vet College, Emily Snyder, brought it to my attention. And there was a unknown outbreak of disease in, I think it was New Mexico and Texas at the time, in the panhandle kind of area. And mostly what they were seeing was decreased milk production and cows kind of suddenly drying off. The milk was described as being thickened and discolored, colostrum-like. And then some of the cows, they'll become lethargic, develop a fever, gets dehydration, and tacky and loose feces. But the milk production decrease is probably the most marked thing that I think people notice at the beginning. And it was at the individual level, so it would be quite marked at the individual level, but then just in general with the herd level of production was also decreasing among some of these herds.
What percentage of cattle were affected on some of these farms? It's been identified on a number of farms in a number of different states, and maybe we can talk about that a little bit later now, but what percentage of cattle were affected?
Yeah, from the information that I've read, and again, most of my information is from USDA, APHIS has some really good, has a really good website and has sent us some great information, but from what I understand, herds are reporting about 10% of the cattle on the premises being affected with clinical signs. But I do wonder a little bit, since the clinical signs are fairly nonspecific, if it's possible that more cattle may have been initially affected, but we'll never really know that before it was really noticed that there's, you know, that this grouping of associated signs was actually a syndrome that was occurring.
Right. And like with any new disease, we try to come up with a case definition, and I'm not sure we have a perfect case definition for this. So it becomes difficult to count cases and sort of say, yes, for sure. Obviously, I guess we isolate that particular virus. We're pretty confident it's a case, but just based on clinical signs, that may be difficult to count cases because the signs are relatively subtle. Maybe the last question, Nathan, for now, does it kill cows?
No, as far as I've seen, we haven't had any death in cattle from H5N1 in any of the infected herds associated with the outbreak. It seems like for most of the herds, kind of, you know, symptoms are fairly mild overall, and they usually, you know, peak around 2 to 5 days, peak at around 15 days in terms of the outbreak. But as far as actually severe disease and death, it doesn't seem that we're seeing that. Probably the most severe thing would be in some of the cattle we see the current lactation, if they're lactating cattle, that lactation may actually end. So that's one of the most severe things. We have seen some spillover infection in cats on these farms, and we have seen some deaths in the cats. I don't know what level that has been, but in cattle, nothing.
Interesting. I think one of the recent webinars I watched, it looks like many of those cows do come back in their lactation, not badly. So I think some of the initial ones, we were more worried that they would almost stop lactating completely. But it sounds like most of them come back in 2 or 3 weeks to 90-95% of what they were milking before. So it does affect their lactation curve, but maybe not quite as badly as we initially thought. So it'd be interesting to see how that changes over time or what we learn about that. At first, we didn't know what the cause of these symptoms were. I remember the first webinar I watched with the ABP, they were talking about this mystery disease and they were submitting samples to all the different diagnostic labs. But they've isolated this influenza A virus that they're now calling bovine influenza A virus, as it appears to have jumped to cattle. And maybe Dr. Ellis, I'll get you to start to give us a little primer on influenza viruses. There's so many different strains and serotypes. Can you enlighten us on the way we describe these viruses in nature?
Yeah, the influenza viruses comprise a big family of agents, and they're currently subdivided into 4 subfamilies, if you will, A, B, C, and D. And A contains the most important pathogen, certainly in mammals and, for that matter, in birds as well. And yes, as you said, there are multiple different serotypes, which kind of adds to the confusion. And the serotyping is based on the distribution of 2 glycoproteins on the viral surface, the hemagglutinin, which is, there's 18 different types, and the neuraminidase, which is 11 different types. And that's based traditionally on the serology, on a serological assessment of those proteins. And I guess the important thing to remember, without getting too far into the weeds, as John has said, there's many different strains and isolates, and there's, I think, some misuse of the terms as well. So, for instance, the H1N1 virus, within one serotype, there can be a tremendous variance in virulence. And so, for instance, the Spanish flu that everyone's heard about from World War I era was an H1N1 virus, whereas seasonal flus currently are H1N1 viruses as well. So the serotype per se doesn't necessarily tell you that much about the virulence. And virulence is determined primarily, simplistically, on the basis of how well the virus replicates. So higher load of virus is usually attributable to higher replication rates. And part of that has to do with the processing of the hemagglutinin and protein and how easily it gets into the cell. And it's, of course, more complicated than that. But that's kind of, a primer on the influenza viruses.
So this is an H5N1 virus. That H is the hemagglutinin and the N is neuraminidase, those particular proteins. It's a type A virus. We've seen influenza D virus as a potential component of respiratory disease in beef cattle. There's been some recent research on that. John, can you describe what we know about influenza D virus?
Well, yeah, that over the past decade or so, there's been more interest in that. And what's interesting, at least what we know so far, is if we think about the influenza A viruses, the reservoirs are thought to be birds, primarily waterfowl, whereas if you do an internet search on influenza D, for instance, they'll talk about cattle actually being the reservoir for the infection. And so at this point, there's some controversy about the importance of this agent in bovine respiratory disease. Certainly, it seems to be very prevalent depending on where the survey was done and what time it was done. There's a high seroprevalence to influenza D in cattle populations. And probably like most flu viruses and most species, as you've already alluded to, it's with regard to cattle returning to lactation, it's usually a pretty mild disease. And so it probably becomes important or more important when we talk about secondary bacterial infections associated with it. But nevertheless, at this point, its importance, I think, is still relatively unknown. And it's different than the influenza A viruses because it only has one glycoprotein, a hemagglutinin esterase. So it's a little bit different structurally than the other viruses that we're mainly concerned with.
Okay, and you kind of mentioned this, John, but the typical reservoir host for this strain that's been identified in these cattle in the U.S. is wild birds, and I think particularly shorebirds and waterfowl is probably the most likely source of the virus. Is there some speculation of other hosts along with that?
Are you talking about D or A?
A.
Yeah, what's interesting so far, at least in the initial reports, is it apparently wasn't waterfowl in the Texas outbreak. It was grackles and pigeons, so birds that were more associated with terrestrial lifestyles. And so that's kind of different. The other thing that's kind of interesting and repeatable with these avian influenza types is they notice dead cats. And so the point of that is that a lot of people forget, which might stem some of the panic, is that influenza viruses in general, even the highly pathogenic ones, can infect a whole variety of mammals, but it's usually a dead-end host situation. And which begs the question, well, why? How does virus get around? Well, different species of animals have different distribution of receptors for the virus in different parts of their body. So, for instance, a cat that, you know, thinks he's lucky and finds a dead bird that's died of influenza has a high dose of virus, that animal can then get very sick and die from that infection, whereas it's very unlikely to spread to other cats. And that's when it becomes a dangerous situation, when it not only gets into a so-called abnormal host, but is then able to spread it within that host population. And that certainly hasn't happened, as far as we know, with the bovine influenza A so as yet.
And is there any history of influenza A virus jumping to ruminant species in the past? Have we heard of this before?
Well, there's actually quite a long history of looking for influenza A viruses in cattle. And some of it, the data is a little bit shaky, but I think certainly it has occurred previously, and it maybe just hasn't been looked for. There are serological studies going back 60 years that have looked for influenza A viruses and documented seroprevalence in cattle populations. And so whether or not this is really that new or unique is I think up for grabs at this point.
That's interesting. And Nathan noted, I think in our notes here, our show notes, that there was a diagnosis of some goats being infected in Minnesota earlier in the past year, 2023, I think. So interesting. But I think poultry on that same farm had been positive as the goats. Is that right, Nathan?
Yeah, I guess there had been an ongoing outbreak in poultry on that farm. And so I'm not sure what type of farm it was, if it was, you know, a backyard type flock where it easily spread somehow to the goats and how that spread would have happened. But yeah, it seems like that's an ongoing infection as well. I also found this this one document that was interesting from the World Organization for Animal Health. They had a surveillance article that they had recently written looking at highly pathogenic avian influenza, different types from 2016 to 2022. And when they were looking at where the new animal category reports, so new animal infections, as far as non-human mammals were going, out of the new animals that were being infected, that hadn't been infected previously or noticed to be infected, only 1.6%, so 7 out of 439 were non-human mammals. So it seems like it's mainly, again, still what they're seeing worldwide is still mainly among birds. So it's relatively uncommon to be jumping still right now.
And you brought up that term there, Nathan, highly pathogenic versus low pathogenicity when we talk about avian influenza viruses. John, do you want to maybe give a comment on what that means?
Yes, I've already sort of mentioned virulence is associated with several things, but at least to begin with, hemagglutinin is a complicated protein which actually has to be cleaved by host enzymes to infect the cell. So the cleavability of the hemagglutinin is actually a marker for virulence. So, for instance, the H1N1 Spanish flu virus was more easily cleaved and made it more infectable, if you will, by the host enzymes. And so that's one factor. And another factor is has to do with the polymerase activity and how efficiently the virus replicates in once it gets inside the cell. That varies amongst isolates. And as well, believe it or not, the host, as in many situations, contributes to the disease. And some of the very virulent, highly pathogenic avian viruses are very good at stimulating the host innate immune response and kind of goes out of control, and that's a big part of the disease. So there are several factors that are associated with virulence. And arguably, importantly, most simply, just the ability to infect cells.
Interesting. And I think also when they talk about highly pathogenic, they're talking about the effects in chickens primarily. And
correct.
Now we've got this virus in a bovine population, that doesn't necessarily mean it's highly pathogenic in bovine. It just meant that it was highly pathogenic in chickens, and now it's in bovine, and it may not act the same way in that population at all.
Exactly. And that, you know, can have to do simply too with the ability of those bird viruses to get into the mammal cell, because there's different receptors for bird and mammal influenza viruses. And there's differences in the distribution of those receptors, again, in different species.
Well, that leads perfectly into my next question, John. So how do these influenza viruses change within a population and suddenly jump like this to a new species or a different species like this?
Well, influenza viruses are single-stranded RNA viruses, which kind of defines that they're very mutable. So they mutate in basically two different ways. Like all viruses, they undergo what's called antigenic drift, which means there's point mutations mostly in the genes coding for the H and N protein, which changes the ability or can change the ability of the virus to infect cells. That's one way they change. Another way they change, which is sort of unique to influenza viruses, is they have what's called segmented genomes, which means the genome is broken up into different segments, rather than being a single linear piece of RNA, so that if a bird, for instance, or a pig is infected with two different isolates of the virus at the same time, then those viruses can reassort. In other words, they can switch their some of their genetic material back and forth. And that's usually, at least historically, the situation that determines whether or not there's the emergence of a pandemic virus. And so they change slowly by antigenic drift, and then they can change rapidly by this so-called antigenic shift, which is associated with reassortment.
Yeah, those influenza viruses have that remarkable ability to adapt and change like that. So Nathan, now that it's in cattle, do we know how it's spread? I think we have some evidence there's cow-to-cow spread, as well as perhaps spread from birds to cattle. What do we know about that transmission?
Yeah, I think we're still defining that overall. But yeah, there's definitely some strong suspicion that from the birds anyways. We know that birds are going to shed the virus through their oral, nasal, and fecal secretions. We think about pigeons for sure. And how they like to cohabitate with our cattle, especially in intensively managed cattle. You can imagine how much fecal material must be spread through those pens and into the feed bunks, et cetera. So I would have a strong suspicion that we would be having spread and contact the cattle through some sort of contamination of feed sources. I guess it is potential that it could be fomite spread too. So fomite could be, you know, cleaning pens and then using those pens, or sorry, using those vehicles then to feed the cattle and them being in contact with fecal material, but some sort of spread of that fecal material is probably most likely. From animal to animal in the cattle, I think we're still figuring that out, but they do shed again the virus, so it is possible, I guess, for spread between animals through secretions. We do know that it gets into milk, certainly. That's one of the materials that we test to identify whether the cattle are positive for H5N1. So definitely spread through feeding of raw and pasteurized milk to calves or in other feed sources, like some sort of contamination that would be possible within the cattle population. And then also some of the spillover into, say, cats. You know, are we feeding the cats some of this unpasteurized milk? And then another question has also come up too, is so we have all of this waste milk. What do we do with this waste milk? Because we don't want to use any of this milk from animals that are shedding H5N1. So to dispose of it properly, we really need to pasteurize it, even if we're just putting it into lagoons, because we could have, there is some concern from USDA about spread back to wildlife. I don't know how readily that would happen if we're putting that milk and diluting it out in lagoons, but it is a possibility, I guess, that they're concerned about.
Anything to add on that, Dr. Ellis?
Yeah, again, I think the critical factor here is going to be the adaptability of the virus. In other words, is there going to be a genetic change in that avian flu virus isolate that allows it to better replicate in cattle? And then, if again, the thing to watch for is the hard evidence of spread within the new species. If that doesn't occur, then this is not unlike avian flu incidents in mammals previously.
Right.
And so, whether or not that's going to happen is really the thing to watch out for.
Yeah. And I'll just throw that caveat out there. We don't know all the answers to these things yet. That's still being learned. It's very early days. I've even seen some suggestions that there might be transfer via milking machines and through fomites at milking from cow to cow. So who knows? We don't know all the answers to that. And certainly there's probably transmission from farm to farm in a number of ways. We can get into that in a second as well. So along those lines, let's start with Dr. Ellis. What's your prediction? Do you think this is going to spread, or is this going to come to Canada eventually? What's the likelihood of that?
Well, I think it's probably going to come to Canada, but I don't like to be Chicken Little, if you will, in terms of the potential panic or the panic that's currently occurring. I think this is probably not unlike what's happened with other avian flu isolates in the past in terms of jumping to mammals and not really taking off in that new species. And we're just looking harder now than we have in the past. So again, based on the probabilities of what's happened in the past, and not that we won't have a black swan event here, but pardon all the bird references, but you know, my prediction, betting on the odds of past events, I'd say it's not going to take off in cattle. So there's probably not a big reason to panic.
And it seems like it's a relatively mild disease for the most part in cattle to date, and not a major mortality issue or anything like that. What about beef cows? This is the Beef Cattle Health and Nutrition Podcast, Nathan. We want to talk about beef cattle. Is this just a dairy cow problem, or are we going to see this? Could we see this in beef cattle as well?
Yeah, again, like Dr. Ellis is saying, I think that we need to use some be fairly conservative, because I don't think we should panic too much. However, being that they're the same species, right? So cattle are cattle. There's a chance if a dairy cow can be infected, then a beef cow could be infected, a feedlot calf could be infected as well. So it is possible, but I think you need to think about the differences between the production systems as well and what the actual risks are. So probably if we looked at feedlots, maybe they're both dairy and beef are both, or feedlots are both fairly intensively managed. So maybe they may share some of the similar risks, but there's some strong differences, like you identified about milking systems. So dairy cattle clearly are being brought through a milking parlor a few times a day. So if the parlor happens to be one of the major sources of infection or spread, that's not going to happen in feedlot system. Those feedlot cattle, they stay in their pen except for maybe a couple times where they get re-implanted, revaccinated, whatever, when we'd have our major pen moves. So probably a little less likely in them just because of management. And then I think about the beef cows and the cow-calf operations. Okay, they're more extensively managed, so hopefully spread shouldn't happen as likely. However, they do have a lot of access and contact with migratory birds, so we do have to consider that in some ways, especially when we're watering our cattle in sloughs, lagoons, etc. So they could potentially have more contact, but again, they're much more extensive, so the chance of acquiring a sufficient dose may be less. It's hard to say at this point, but it's possible, but I don't know how high the risk is going to be.
Exactly. I don't think just because they're beef cattle that they're going to be immune, that's for sure, but obviously the risks are very different in terms of the management. We should point out this is a potential zoonotic disease. It does infect people sometimes, but according to the USDA, there's no risk from eating properly cooked meat or drinking pasteurized milk. There shouldn't be any issues with it jumping to people in any great extent other than the people that work with cattle, I suppose. So what are the recommendations to keep human health safe?
Some of the recommendations I've seen, like you say, the people that are working with cattle the closest, so on-farm employees, veterinarians that are working with cases, et cetera. So making sure they're wearing the proper PPE when they're working with infected animals and that they're washing well. Really, I mean, it's standard things that we should be doing anyway. It's not really any different than how we would manage E. coli, making sure that we don't get diarrhea from handling our cattle, right? And then the other, I guess, is looking at that pasteurization and making sure that we are pasteurizing. We're only consuming pasteurized milk and milk products. And it's going to, I think, cause some problems or some difficulty for producers. But ensuring that all waste milk is also pasteurized, that'll be a big challenge if that is truly going to be a point of spread for the herd.
Well, let's just talk about spread from herd to herd. There's probably two ways this can be spread. Potentially by birds as they migrate and move around, but it could also be spread by moving cattle around. And it looks like a fair number of the spread in some of the farms in the U.S. have been by cattle movements and not by bird movements necessarily, at least as far as they can tell, I think. What do you think the likelihood of spread is either way? And are there any things we can do to minimize that?
Yeah, definitely we should have some biosecurity precautions that we're going to take. Like you say, we did see, or we have seen spread from farms through animal movement. So we definitely can bring infected animals onto other premises. So one of the pillars is going to be managing the movement of cattle, maybe delaying or stopping return of cattle or movement of new cattle onto farms. If that can't be stopped, then be looking at potentially quarantining the animals for a period of time. 2 to 3 weeks is what is the recommendation right now, but the incubation and duration of disease and shedding isn't really fully understood yet from cattle, from what I understand. So that 2 to 3 weeks may be sufficient, may not be sufficient, could be overkill. We don't know where that'll end up yet. But managing movement is definitely something that we should consider. On farm, you can think also about minimizing access then of wild birds to the cattle and their environment. Clearly, this is not an easy thing to do. So they're recommending things like doing hazing to use non-lethal force to try to discourage birds from cohabitating with cattle. But again, that's a pretty big challenge overall, if you know the nature of birds and how they move. Again, looking at that pasteurization and not feeding unpasteurized colostrum or milk to calves would be something that they're asking us to look at. And, you know, monitoring health of animals as well very closely, especially for moving animals onto the farm. When you're creating these pens of cattle, if you're having to isolate them, making sure you're not continually adding new cattle into these groups, because that's going to change the amount of time that you're going to have to keep them isolated for, right? Every time you add in new animals. So that's going to be also challenging for people because it depends on how many pens they have for being able to do this. So it's not without any massive challenges. And then using disinfectants. So they have some pretty good lists of disinfectants that can be used for particular materials. Again, you're not going to be able to disinfect an entire farm, but you can disinfect like the milking machines, equipment, etc., your boots, things that are easily disinfectable. And then working with the animals in an appropriate manner too, either having dedicated care workers and equipment for those animals or working with them last, milking them last, if we have infected ones, just using some kind of common sense management of the animals as well. And then just keeping an eye on wildlife in the area too. If you see anything really weird, some odd acting animals, especially birds, odd behaviors, sudden deaths, etc., report it, and just to be cautious of it.
Yeah, and most of the biosecurity recommendations that you see on the American Association of Bovine Practitioner website, they're pretty common sense things that we should be doing anyway. The BCRC has some great resources for biosecurity and disease prevention, and I'll put a link in the show notes to those. They're well worth checking out for that are directed more to beef cattle producers. And so have a look at those as well. I'll put those on the show notes. We don't know if this will emerge in herds in Canada. We're just making our best guesses at this point. But what should a producer do if they suspect they have a cow with these types of clinical signs, Nathan?
I think you should definitely contact your local veterinarian. And I think there's been enough information brought to the veterinary community that they'll be able to guide now an initial investigation to, you know, indicate whether we should be really suspicious or not. And even if at this point we're unsure, then at least then we can create contact with the appropriate authorities to decide whether some sort of testing should be done. In Saskatchewan right now, the contact is going to be the provincial disease surveillance veterinarian, so Dr. Wendy Wilkins, and that's who the veterinarians will be contacting, and then they will help guide us in what the next steps would be and initiate testing of the most appropriate animals.
Yeah, I think the provinces may all be handling it slightly differently, but they'll probably be, your local veterinarian will probably know who to contact and sort that out about testing if it does occur. I know the diagnostic labs are getting ready to be able to do this and they have the appropriate tests ready to go and things like that. Did we miss anything? Is there anything else we should mention before we wrap this up today, Dr. Ellis, Dr. Erickson?
No, I think that brings us up to date. As you mentioned to begin with, this is a moving target. It's a rapidly moving target in terms of news every day. And so I guess for those in the livestock industry overall, it's something to be aware of and keep monitoring as a rapidly changing situation.
Exactly. This might be a podcast that becomes outdated very quickly, but who knows? We'll see how that goes. So thank you so much for being here today, guys. I really appreciate it. Dr. Ellis, Dr. Erickson, both great knowledge and expertise that you've given us about this, and we'll see what happens. Thanks again.
Thank you.
That's the show for this week. Thanks to all of you for listening to the podcast, and thanks again to my guests, Dr. Nathan Erickson and Dr. John Ellis. Thank you as well to our sponsors, the Alberta Beef Producers and the Beef Cattle Research Council. Please consider subscribing wherever you get your podcasts. And if you have questions or comments or would like to suggest topics that you'd like to see covered in future episodes, please email me at bchnpodcast@gmail.com. Take care till next time.